Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Hello, old friends. I'm Brian Brinkman.
I'm David Goldstein. It's August 23rd, 2021, the dog days of August, and you're lucky to be listening to The Drop.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Dropland. I am Brian Brinkman. That is David Goldstein. We are hanging out here, as Dave said, in the dog days of summer, transitioning into fall here slowly but surely. It's still quite warm here, although today, as of recording, was the first time I stepped outside before 7 a.m. and felt a chill in the air. And that Denver early morning chill, that late night chill, it's one of my favorite times of year. You still get the warmth in the middle of the day, but you know that things are going to cool down in the morning and in the evening. It's fantastic. I'm really excited about this episode as well. We got a lot of cool stuff that we're going to dive into. My head has been kind of spinning with the topics that we're going to be discussing here. But before we do that, David, how are you doing?
I'm pretty good. It's a little bit tropical here in New York City. A little humid, but I'm doing well. Actually, Sunday, my family's going to spend a few days in Northampton, Massachusetts. We have a friend who's going out of town, so they're saying, stay in our house for a week. So we said, sure. We enjoy up in Western Mass. And I think after that, we're going to try to go to Vermont for a few days because neither school nor daycare in New York City starts until September 13th. So that leaves us a lot of time without childcare to try to do new, creative, and interesting things for our lovable but somewhat rambunctious girls. So I figured the more time we can spend in nature, out of the apartment, the better off we will be. So that's good. Looking forward to doing that. Unfortunately, as of the time of this recording, my New York Mets are getting dangerously close to playing out the string as the bottom has dropped out. They're playing elite teams on the West Coast now and not rising up to the level of their competition. But that's okay. I figured this was going to happen at some point. So it is what it is. It's you can put a multi-billionaire gazillionaire in charge of the team and they're still going to Mets all the way home. So, you know.
He had to know that, though. He had to know what he was getting into. Like, he's a diehard fan, right?
Yeah. Like, allegedly a diehard fan. He grew up in Great Neck, New York, supposedly grew up going to games. So, yeah, it's a transitional year. He's still learning how to be an owner and whether or not he wants to, like, call the team out on Twitter, kind of embracing his inner George Steinbrenner, still kind of seeing if that's a good idea. It all depends what happens in the offseason. There's definitely going to be some decisions to make with regards to contract extensions, qualifying offers, and I can pretty much guarantee the hitting coach will be gone. We'll have to see about the manager. Guess the manager gets at least one more year to prove himself, but unless things turn around significantly, you're going to see some different guy manning the hitting coach position, certainly.
Yeah, your Mets are playing on the West Coast right now, which is, so I live in Denver, Colorado, for all of our listeners who don't know that. I think I say it in every episode, though, but I'll just keep reminding you. I'm a huge proponent of the notion that the Mountain time zone is the best time zone to watch sports in. Because anything on the East Coast, anything in Eastern time starts late enough in the day, but early enough that like I can have it on while I'm cooking dinner. The second game for like basketball always comes on about 8 o'clock, and I can enjoy that into the evening. But really, during the summer, during baseball season, I get early games that start around 4:35, and then I get the late West Coast games, the Seattle, the Oakland, the San Francisco, the Los Angeles, the San Diego. I think that there's another team in there, but they may be a fake team from a Disney movie. Is Anaheim even a really real city? But I get all of these late West Coast games. I guess you could throw in the Arizona Diamondbacks in there, but who wants to watch them? But I'll throw them on depending on who they're playing. I was actually watching a Phillies Diamondbacks game last night. It was quite good. But, you know, all this said and done, I get to watch a late night baseball game that when I was on the East Coast was just totally unreachable to me. And so I've been watching a lot of Mets the last week. It's been a lot of fun.
I loved the late night West Coast games when I was in law school, because I would just like take caffeine and stay up and be like, oh, 10 o'clock. Awesome. I can watch baseball and go to bed at like 2 o'clock. But now when the 10 o'clock Mets games, the problem is I have a hard time going to bed until I know the outcome of the game, but they don't end until like 1 o'clock, but I can't stay up that late. So I'll just lie awake in bed and sometimes check my phone and see that they're losing. So it's like, all right, fuck. So I woke myself up and they're losing. So now I'm not going to get to bed another half hour.
It feels like a lost like week when your team plays out west and you're on the East Coast.
Yeah.
Like it feels like you just have no idea what's happening. You wake up the next morning, you're like, wait, we were up 6-4 and then we lost the game 8-7. What in the hell happened? And it's this kind of weird in-between period, you know, just when you're not in this region of the country. So I'm enjoying it. I'm still watching the Cubs, even though I don't recognize half the players. My son is still insisting on watching the Cubs. We got to enjoy our first 2-game winning streak, if you could call it a streak, this week. It was the first time they won back-to-back games since late July. So we are definitely in the dog days. A lot of guys are starting to get called up, tested out for the Cubs. It's that type of season. And as I keep telling everyone, I have become a Mets, Yankees, White Sox, Red Sox, Giants, and Oakland Athletics fan here for the remainder of the year. Those are where my guys are, just hoping at least one of them ends up in the NL or ALCS. But that said, we wanted to talk quickly about some big releases that came out this week. We're starting to get to a time of the year where we're seeing Fridays bring out some really big releases and some controversial ones, but also some good ones. So some new releases that came out here this week that we wanted to talk about. Def Heaven put out a record called Infinite Granite. Lord put out a record called Solar Power. Angel Olsen put out an EP called Isles, which is all covers of 80s pop songs. Nathan Salzberg put out a record called Psalms. We talked about him earlier this past year. And James McMurtry put out a record, The Horses and the Hounds. There was also a Sturgill Simpson drop, wasn't there?
Yeah, it was sort of not quite a surprise, but he kind of just announced it casually, I think like a month ago, and it came out today. I think it's called The Ballad of Dude and Juanita, kind of a concept record that's a tribute to his grandparents that's in the same bluegrass style as his last two records. I started listening to it this morning. A little disappointed that it's only 28 minutes long, because with a guy like Sturgill, you want as much as you can possibly get, and 28 minutes is kind of EP length, but I trust that he knows what he's doing, so definitely look forward to diving into that one.
Yeah, I listened to the Def Heaven record this morning. It's gorgeous. It's an absolutely amazing album. I have Sunbather, obviously, that was the record that really attracted a ton of fans to them back in 2013. That was one of my favorite records that year. New Bermuda came out in 2015. I absolutely loved that record. And then we got into their record from 2018.
Is it Ordinary Corrupt Human Love?
Yeah, we connected that to some Fish Jam from summer 2018. I'm blanking on it now, but I'll dig in the BTP archives and see if I can't find that.
Yeah, I can't recall the jam. I think the song was Honeycomb.
Yes, the song was Honeycomb.
Big part where the heavens open up. This big D major, Smashing Pumpkins, like heavens opening up, raining down from the sky.
It was the Gorge 2018 Chalk Dust Torture. It was like that big 20-minute Chalk Dust Torture that goes into this D major territory. And we were like, that sounds like the new Def Heaven record. We connected that to that. I really enjoyed my first spin of this record. And I'm excited for further spins here in the future, because I think it's one of those records that's going to linger here into the fall really nicely.
Yeah, I got to listen to like the first 25 minutes of that on a walk this morning. And whereas past Def Heaven records, I guess, have been classified as like black gaze or death gaze, because they combine the shoegaze with the shrieking black metal vocals of the singer George Clark. On this record, he makes a point to sing clean vocals, and a lot of the heaviness has been excised in favor of just, they went full shoegaze. I mean, to me, it sounds like they listened to the last Slow Dive record and said, oh, let's do that. And we love that Slow Dive record. That's a great album.
Yeah.
And if anyone from like upper management is listening to this, I would say get a copy of Infinite Granite into the hands of one Ernest J. Anastasio III as soon as possible. So in the fall, we can start hearing some crazy shoegaze jams. I think Trey would like this record a lot. It's just really pretty and expansive. And there's, you know, some bits are already like throwing your arms to the heaven like Charlie Sheen in Platoon.
Yeah, this record could be the could have the impact on one Mr. Anastasio the way that Loveless has for the last 30 or 40 years. So
yeah.
I'd be very, very excited to hear his thoughts on this. Yeah, I'm excited to dig into all these. I have not yet listened to the Lord record. We both loved Melodrama from 2017, I believe it was.
Yeah, her second record was great. The singles from the new Lord record haven't excited me quite as much. I like the title track because I like stuff that bites Primal Scream, but we'll see.
And then before we jump into kind of the meat of the episode, we wanted to talk through Fish's first leg of their summer 2021 tour. Just give a quick thought breakdown of kind of how the tour went, what our thoughts are on this. Dave, I know I enjoyed this tour overall. We spent a lot of time, you, myself, and our good friend Josh Carver. Shout out to Nola Sox. We have to get him on the pod at some point in time. Half of our drop planning episodes are done in a DM thread with Josh Carver. We all really enjoyed a lot of this tour. I think we took some issue with a few sets here and there. But on the whole, what were kind of your big thematic takeaways of Fish's first tour in 2 years? What were your thoughts on it?
Well, look, I mean, I think that Deer Creek Night 1 might be their best two-set show since December 30th, 2018. I mean, maybe Alpine Valley 3 from 2019 and 1230 comes close. No? Okay.
I don't agree with that, but I'm on the same page with you as 1230-18. Like, it's one of those shows that, like, everything connected.
Yeah,
there's not a single part that I want to skip past.
That's just a serious fucking Fish show, and it was the best show of the tour, but there was nearly every show had a significant highlight.
Yeah.
Just because they sort of abandoned some of the 20, 30-minute jams in favor of more like 13, 15-minute stuff towards by the time you got to Hershey in Atlantic City. Kind of with the level of creativity throughout was still extremely high. I mean, I keep telling everyone I was a bit worried by Arkansas, but then the next night in Alabama really allayed any fears that I had. And you're getting lots of effects pedal, lots of extremely inventive stuff from Page, and Deer Creek 1 kind of cast such a huge shadow that all the other shows kind of couldn't help but seem a little meager compared to it. But I think you look back and see that many of these shows have significant legs, and I really think for the first time back in 18 months, it was clear they were chomping at the bit and really practicing, and it really came out. I mean, maybe by AC they were a little bit tired, which is to be expected given the ages of the band members, but I thought it was great.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, like, to your point, if you take a tour at its full, you know, overall look of however many shows there were, you can really judge, like, the quality of a tour on the floor and the peak. And I think you're absolutely right that the peak of this tour was that Deer Creek Night 1. And that show, to me, was so fully connected. And, you know, you wonder, in a sense, what would have happened if they took an alternative path following Wilson and played four or five songs rather than played this fully connected, simple jam. I think that we would look at it more like the median of the larger tour, whereas that simple jam really cemented the show as, like, wow, they are going for it and they're connected and they are not letting up. And that was something that, like, as the tour progressed and as it moved to Hershey and as it moved to Atlantic City, we saw them stray away from that fourth quarter jam. However, to me, the two sets that dominate this tour and really showcase the band at their absolute best in terms of what they were going for, in my own perception for the tour, are Nashville Night 2, Set 2, and Hershey Night 2, Set 2. Both of them feature consistent and high-level improvisation. Neither jam goes past 20 minutes. Neither jam focuses on, you know, breaking that, like, third, fourth barrier of, like, going out into totally uncharted territory. But both show a fully connected band in a melodic, songwriting-focused fashion, and both feature really great setlist choices. I would also throw in there, on a slight tier below, but also, you know, still very, very strong, Deer Creek Night 2, Set 2, as well as Atlantic City Night 2, Set 2, as being sets where, like, the band just figured out a way to create flow in a second set that really holds up on tape in a strong way.
Would certainly agree. Deer Creek Night 2, Set 2 is very, very good, only overshadowed by what came before it, but you'll go back and find some excellent tempo jams in that set. And The Ghost from AC Night 2 definitely has a lot in 12 minutes, like some dark, sustained, like kind of walking through the desert, parched jamming. That was a really, really excellent set. The Drowned and That Ghost. It was probably my favorite set of the whole AC run.
Yeah, and now we've got, as this episode goes live, at the end of this week, the band will launch their second leg of the summer tour. We have three nights at the Gorge, which should be fantastic. Two nights in Tahoe, and then three nights to wrap up the summer tour at Dick's, where I will be seeing my first Phish shows in 2 years. Very, very excited about that. And then we'll have a short break before the band comes back for a fall tour. And fall tour on the West Coast should be fantastic. I'm really excited for it. I'm hoping to catch a few shows. Last thing we want to do here in the top of the episode is run through our favorite recent Osiris Media podcast releases. We are a part of Osiris Media here at The Drop. We love what we do here as a larger podcast network and a larger media company. And we want to showcase for you all some of the best work of our compatriots and our colleagues. So, Dave, what do you want to feature here in your weekly Osiris Rec?
So there was recently, I think last week, the podcast Comes a Time. Of course, it's the podcast hosted by Lucille Burbridge and Mike Fenoya, when, you know, they usually interview luminaries of the jam band world, kind of like the further out, like Grateful Dead world. And they kind of keep it light and conversational. But this week they had on the podcast Fred Guttenberg, who is the anti-gun lobby activist, of course, who had a daughter, was murdered in the Parkland shooting back in, I think it was Valentine's Day of 2018. And as such, it was kind of like a much more somber, much more serious episode of Comes a Time. Fred Guttenberg, he's known for very much putting himself out there. He's extremely active on Twitter. He's extremely active in lobbying the government and staying on top of things to, in his words, break the effing gun lobby. And while certainly aspects of the podcast were sad, it also, you know, ends up being somewhat hopeful in the fact that he kind of does run through exactly what President Biden is doing in his power with a divided Senate to kind of, you know, crack down on gun violence. You know, he goes on to say that what's kind of crazy is that, like, even people that are gun owners, like 90% of Americans believe that there should be more gun safety and more gun issues in place. And just because you happen to own a gun doesn't mean that you aren't responsible, or, you know, doesn't mean that you don't want things to be as safe as possible. So while it certainly strikes a somber tone, he kind of tells people how they can get involved, how people should go ahead and get involved. And, you know, I kind of, listening to it, you get a good idea of the horrible epidemic of gun violence in America, while at the same time kind of you get an idea that not all it is entirely lost, so long as, you know, we stay active and stay on our toes. So that was, I thought it was somber, but a very good change of pace from a podcast that I like a lot.
Yeah, I need to listen to that as someone who just sent his son to kindergarten for the first time and is now reliant on the public education system to keep him safe and have him, you know, learning on a consistent basis. It's definitely a thought that has crept into my mind more often than not, and a fear that I consistently have just with regards to the impacts of gun violence on kids in schools. And it's really awesome that Oteil and Mike were able to talk with him. I want to talk about a episode from our colleagues at Jambase, the Jambase pod, which is featured here on Osiris Media, that interviewed MC Taylor of His School, The Messenger, just a couple weeks ago. You know, if you know Dave and I, we are big fans of MC Taylor's songwriting. We are big fans of His School, The Messenger as a larger band. I've seen them a number of times. They're a fantastic live show. MC Taylor's written some of my favorite songs of the last probably 10 years. And his 2016 record, Heart Like a Levee, was one of my absolute favorite records of the decade. The conversation, it kind of goes in a somber tone as well, which I don't think is our intention right now, but we're in kind of this unknown terrain right now with what's happening, both from political and as well as a health, public health standpoint in this country. He gets into the weeds about the process of booking shows, shifting gears on health recommendations and health requirements, and the communication between artists and venues. Hmm. Over the last couple of weeks, we've seen a lot of artists, including Phish, including Jason Isbell, including a lot of larger festivals, AEG, I think Live Nation just made a requirement as well, that proof of vaccination or 72-hour/48-hour negative COVID test is required for entry at any concert going forward. Personally speaking, I'm of the mindset that there needs to be stricter requirements here. We should be requiring everyone to be vaccinated to go to a concert. But that's kind of something that we'll see if that comes along here, as depending on what Delta does. But MC Taylor goes into the details about the risks that artists are taking, the importance that they're putting on public health and public safety for both themselves, for their crews, for the venues that they're playing at, for the audience members, and the risks that they're taking large scale to keep touring alive. We saw a great interview a couple weeks ago with Jason Isbell on, I believe it was MSNBC, talking about the real challenges that the live music industry is facing and the music industry as a whole in terms of true survival when it comes to playing shows. They have to be playing shows right now. They cannot survive another lockdown. They can't survive holding off tours into 2022. So musicians have to play. Those of us who have been vaccinated deserve to be in a setting where we can let our guard down a little bit and savor live music in a way that we haven't. But there's got to be a lot of safety precautions taken with it. And MC Taylor gets into the details on that in a really fascinating way that, like I said, it kind of gets into the weeds of the conversations that are happening right now in real time. Really made me empathize and understand kind of what artists are going through, the challenges that they face already from being on the road, combined now with the challenges of trying to deal with touring in the midst of a pandemic. Beyond that, he talks a bit about recording his last record, Quietly Blowing It, a record that was recorded last fall at the height of the pandemic. Talks about the challenges of the recording process, as well as kind of his songwriting and song craftsmanship approach, and how he, you know, has gotten to a point where he knows how he wants a song to sound. He builds out the entire song and then brings in these fantastic musicians who take his ideas and just take them into a completely different place that he could never anticipated them going, which is really just cool to listen to kind of his own process. So highly recommend the Jambase pod. We love our media partners over there at Jambase, and highly recommend you listen to both Comes a Time and the Jambase pod. All right, so for the meat of this episode, we wanted to take a look back and a deeper look back at the year 2011, 10 years past it. 2011 was a really interesting year in a number of cases from a musical standpoint, but as we were kind of trying to think about what we wanted to talk about here today, you know, we've been going back through every 5 years through kind of our favorite records of those 5 years, and right now we'll feature here later in the episode 1991, but we were looking at 2011, we were realizing, oh my god, Wilco, REM, Radiohead, Fleet Foxes, My Morning Jacket, and TV on the Radio all released records. Not, and that's just like a tip of the iceberg, like massive, massive bands released records in 2011. It's kind of an interesting crux of a year for a lot of these artists, as well as kind of where music was. But I want to ask you first, Dave, you know, what were your thoughts at that point in your life of music that was coming out in 2011? And looking back then, 10 years from now, what does it look like to you from beyond?
It's funny. In 2011... I was at a point in my professional career where I had actually started to operate as a solo practitioner. That started in 2010, carried on in 2011. We didn't have any children at that point, so still I'd been married for a little less than 2 years, feeling relatively young and free. And looking back, a lot of my favorite bands put out some of their most middling records in 2011. It was like there was a groundswell of albums from a lot of big bands that you and I love that have large discographies. But looking back, like Wilco, The Whole Love, totally fine. Not one of my favorite albums by that band. Radiohead, King of Limbs, again, fine. Not what I'm looking for my Radiohead. My Morning Jacket, Circuital, a little bit boring. TV on the Radio, Nine Types of Light, and again, totally fine. That just, for some odd reason, that year ended up kind of hitting at a time when a bunch of bands that we like were on their, like, I don't know, fifth and sixth albums, kind of like the album where they start to turn from the early inspiration into more of, like, product, kind of like a Pearl Jam Riot Act type thing. Actually, REM put out their swan song that year, Collapse Into Now, which is actually an excellent record. It's a very good career summation, has a lot of good songs, and I think people kind of dismiss it just because it came out and they announced their breakup pretty shortly afterwards. So instead of kind of being like a triumphant end, people kind of see it more as just like a coda on their career. But I would definitely recommend people go check that album out. In regard to Fleet Foxes' Helplessness Blues, I actually wrote kind of a somewhat dismissive review of that album for the website Cope Machine Glow I was working for at the time, and that I didn't like it as much as the first, and that I thought it captured the Fleet Foxes' sound without having the songs of the first record. Except the first song and the last song and the one in the middle, three songs were really good, but I didn't like it quite as much as the first Fleet Foxes self-titled. But I think if I go back in 2011 and look at a bunch of the records that we mentioned, I would probably enjoy them more now, as they're significantly dad rocky. The Whole Love, I think, kind of holds up better than it did when it came out when I was younger and more full of vim and vigor than I am now.
Yeah, I mean, I think your point about all of these massive artists relatively speaking, you know, within the larger indie rock world, releasing their kind of fifth and sixth records and them kind of falling slightly flat, I think rings true. I pulled up the Pitchfork 2011 top 10 list. I'll just read it really quickly because I think it's reflective of the point you're making. Number 10, The Weeknd, House of Balloons. Number 9, Real Estate Days. Number 8, Drake, Take Care. 7, Toon Yards, Who Kill. 6, Owen Tricks Point Never, Replica. 5, Girls, Father, Son, Holy Ghost.
Good record. Totally memory hold.
Great record.
Totally memory hold. Good yeah. record.
PJ Harvey, Let England Shake. 3, M83, Hurry Up, We're Dreaming. 2, Destroyer, Kaput. And number 1, Bon Iver, Bon Iver. And kind of my biggest takeaways from reading through that is you're kind of seeing, number 1, aside from PJ Harvey, there aren't a ton of legacy artists on there at that point in time. No. You know, there's, if you went back 10 years earlier and had a Wilco, a Radiohead, TV on the Radio wasn't totally abandoned at that, or wasn't really releasing records at that point in time. But REM, you know, if you had those records that came out in 2001, those are more than likely surefire top 10 Pitchfork records. But aside from PJ Harvey, none of them are in there. Beyond that, you start to see the push towards this kind of 2010 sound as defined by The Weeknd, as defined by Drake, even Toon Yards in terms of this, like, you know, very bloggy soundscape, punk rock, but also like distorting the idea of, you know, what rock music is. Owen Tricks Point Never, who would become one of the biggest sonic landscape artists of the 2010s. So you start to see this push towards the next decade right. in a really interesting way. The other thought I had as I was reading through this, you look at the writers for a number of these, and I'll just go with like the top five here, top six. Owen Tricks Point Never's little blurb is written by Philip Sherburn. Girls is written by Stuart Berman. The M83 one was written by Jason Green. The Destroyer one is written by Ryan Dombal. And the Bon Iver one is written by Amanda Petrusich. You're seeing again a like these newer writers that were really rising up at that point in time during Pitchfork, many of whom have gone on to much bigger things from Pitchfork. Amanda Petrusich, most notably, is the, I think, music critic at The New Yorker. You have kind of this breaking point between what you could put out in 2001 to 2007 and what you could put out between 2011 and 2016. And you see this kind of cultural shift in the top 10 list that is not in any way reflected by the records that you or I would have been really excited about 4 or 5 years earlier.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think a lot of those writers are also pretty similar to at least me in age. I think they're in kind of like their early to mid-40s as well. It's funny with that top 10 list, now that looking back on it, Take Care, that's a really good Drake record. That's my favorite Drake album. Mm. I think that's the one where he kind of had the best beats and the best rhymes, and he kind of established his like sad boy emo form of that would, I guess, serve him well over the years. That PJ Harvey album, Let England Shake, it was pretty good for 2011. I don't think people talk about it that much now because I think it kind of pales a bit compared to the rest of her discography. That was her like anti-war kind of like British history album. As I was saying before, that Girls record, totally great, totally memory hold. And you know how I feel about Toon Yards, Who Kill. That's a great album. That's her peak album. She still puts out good stuff, but that was I think one of my favorite albums of the decade, actually. But just transitioning a little bit, I think when people think of Phish and they think of 2011, they think of very sets that had lots and lots of songs, not a ton of improvisation. That was after 2010. In 2010, they had the excellent fall tour. They played some really tiny venues to get back to their roots. I think the size of the venues increased in 2011. Still lots of songs. Not as much in the way of improv, and people really seem to not like the New Year's Eve run, which I agree wasn't very good. So that kind of sticks out in people's minds when they think of 2011, which may explain why the tour opener in summer 2012 didn't sell out. But I think going back, if you get into the weeds though, 2011, there's a lot to like. now that I look back on it, because I mean, for me, 2011 Phish was kind of, they weren't the furthest thing from my mind at all, but I wasn't fully on board yet. I only saw one show in 2011. That was December 30th. I know I've said in the past, I didn't really get back on the train, so to speak, until more of like the summer of like 2012. So I've kind of enjoyed going back to 2011 with your help, Ryan, seeing what I've missed. Like, what exactly, what comes to your mind when you think of that year now?
Well, I remember, you're absolutely right, the fall 2010 tour and the New Year's Eve run overall, specifically the New Year's Day show, were incredible highs for Phish 2 years into the 3.0 era. And for about five, six months there, going into early 2011, there was no reason to anticipate any sort of a dip. The band seemed on a creative high, and they seemed ready to kind of shake off the shackles of like refiguring out who we are as a band, how we're going to present ourselves. And they opened up the summer tour with three shows at Bethel, with the set of Woodstock, the original Woodstock Festival, with Tweezer. And it felt like a symbolic moment that the band is ready to move beyond this era of kind of these recital sets where they're rediscovering their songs and instead here start to explore their songs in a much more intentional way. The initial summer tour run was fantastic through the July 4th show at Blossom Music Center. Pretty much every show was worth re-listening to. Even kind of the down shows like 529 and 6-1 still had really great moments. But then something happened in early June where the band shifted focus and started reincorporating the song splattering recital type of sets. And you started to get those 25, 23 song set lists again, where they would get into a jamming territory that sounded really cool for a second and then very quickly abandon it. Obviously, the tour and the year in a lot of cases seemed to shift dramatically with the Super Bowl 9 festival over 4th of July weekend, which really shifted on the Storage Jam, which was their first late night set since the Tower Jam 8 years earlier. And the following show, July 3rd, was to that point my favorite show of the entire era. When they came back in August, they incorporated what many people called storage jamming, this kind of industrialized sound. It was very, very different from the type of jamming that they were doing in 2009 and 2010. It was very locked in. It was very experimental. And across a number of jams, the Gorge Rock and Roll, the Tahoe Light, a number of the jams from the UIC run, the Undermine, as well as the Waves, and the Piper from Dix really incorporated this kind of aggressive jamming that the band was reintroducing. They played their first ever run at Dix. It was a huge, huge success. Nobody really knew what to make of this run when it was announced. Nobody knew why Phish was playing in a soccer stadium in Commerce City, Colorado. And nobody really knew why the band was going to, if this would be a tradition or if this would just be a one-off thing. It turned out to be amazing. The S show, both 9-3 and then 9-4, are fantastic shows to close out the run. And we all know what happened. It became an annual tradition for the band. They then didn't tour in the fall. And they came back over New Year's and they played a very subpar New Year's run. And you were absolutely right about that. I think there were a lot of us who were wondering, especially people like myself, who was following every single show from Hampton through this point. I think Phish might break up. I think we might have just reached the end of this experiment. They felt really negative when they walked off the stage on December 31st, 2011. And it took them a while to actually even announce their summer tour for 2012. And when they announced it, it kind of felt like, maybe they're just going to keep playing. Who knows if anything's going to happen? And we all know what happened. They came out in early June, played to a, you know, half empty room in Worcester, Massachusetts.
On Thursday
which
night.
Is shocking on Thursday night, which is shocking to both of us, and played an amazing show and went on to play their best tour to that point in time, which springboarded them further into the next phase of the era. All that said, it's an interesting year that sounds very, very, very different from anything that we've been hearing from Phish over the last couple of years. And I went back and I listened to a number of jams. I'm going to share a playlist when we post this episode.
Yeah.
But I listened to a number of jams that really struck me for creativity and also just a unique sound. And I tried to find a number of jams that are not the tentpole jams that we all talk about. Not the 6-3 Down with Disease, not the 527 Waves, not the 815 Undermine and Waves, not the Gorge Rock and Roll. Some jams that kind of fall between the cracks, but really showcase a lot of creativity. So I'm going to share that when we post this episode. I encourage everyone to check it out on Live Fish. It's a really cool playlist that kind of just runs through some massive creativity throughout the summer of 2011. But I think in summation, it showcased that the band still had a lot to work through to get beyond the initial break and the initial reunion in early 2009. And it also showcased, especially in hindsight, the successes that we would hear from the band through 2012, 2013, 2014, 2015, when the band was able to really lock in around melodic ideas and build jams up in really unique ways. So I definitely encourage everyone to go back and listen to that.
Everybody, so as we have been doing on the drop, coming up on the back end of the podcast, we're gonna just go through one new record each that we've been digging, and then as we keep going back, we're gonna talk about a classic summer album from 1991. So just beginning, I'm gonna talk about a new record that I believe came out last week from a band called Quicksand. The album is called Distant Populations. So Quicksand is a band. Front man's name is, I think, Walter Schreffels. I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce his last name, but he's kind of been a long staple of the New York area hardcore scene. In the early 90s, late 80s, he was in the Gorilla Biscuits. He went on to form the band Rival Schools. Quicksand put out two records in 1993 and 1995, being Slip and Manic Compression. So you could say that Quicksand kind of got described as post-hardcore, which is to say not like a hardcore punk band, but kind of more like a grungy, kind of like lockstep, almost you could say the Fugazi to, if you're talking Ian MacKaye, he had Fugazi. Before that, he had Minor Threat. So you could say that Walter Schreffels, he had like Quicksand. Before that, he had the Gorilla Biscuits, more of a traditional hardcore band. People love those records in 93 and 95. And then they kind of pulled the mission to Burma, and they sort of went on hiatus or broke up for about 22 years. And then in 2017, he came back with the album Interiors, which was very good record, kind of like more spacier, almost like psychedelic version of like post-hardcore music. And then just last week, he put out Distant Populations. So it's a good album. I mean, the guy sounds like he's 52 years old. He doesn't quite have the rage that he had in like the early 90s. But if you like the early Quicksand records, there's a lot to get into here. It's certainly heavy. It's very well produced by a guy named Will Yip. Showcases and produced a lot of bands that kind of meld the like shoegaze to hardcore, which is what happens here. I mean, to my ears, it kind of sounds a lot like the last Deftones record, Ohms, which came out last October. Makes sense now because Quicksand and Deftones, they share a bass player in Sergio Vega. So basically, if you're looking for, I would say, music which is heavy and goes in lockstep, excellent rhythm section, but also with some aspects of shoegaze and psychedelia that guys like me in their early 40s and or people that want heavy music that is both kind of melodic and songy at the same time would definitely do well to check out the latest Quicksand album, Distant Populations. We'll be right back.
I'm going to cheat a little bit here on my new album recommendation. I'm going to jump back to a record that was released in mid-spring that I had not discovered and I hadn't gotten around to listening to. And I was listening to it this week and absolutely loved it. And I recommend it to all of our listeners here. And that is Painted Shrines, Heaven and Holy. Listeners to Beyond the Pond will know that this is my wheelhouse because we get a feature from Woods founder Jeremy Earl. I am a huge Woods fan. Jeremy Earl is one of my favorite singer-songwriters, and he teams up here with psych folk veteran Glenn Donaldson for a record that just feels like the spring and the summer and the fall that we wish it was, and maybe in 2 years it will be, but for a brief moment in time when listening to this record that it's just around 35 minutes, just like feels like that warm back porch mid-afternoon hang with absolutely nothing on the calendar, nothing on the agenda, maybe a little pipe, maybe a beer in hand, a good friend for a few bits of conversation here and there, just soaking in the sunshine, just enjoying the moment is what this record is. So this record is one of those unique non-casualties, beneficiaries of the last year of COVID. This record started in kind of little, like a week-long session between Donaldson and Earl back in 2018. They kind of shelved the sessions. Woods began working on their own record, Strange to Explain, as well as working with one of our favorite singer-songwriters, David Berman, on his final album, Purple Mountains. Donaldson started working on his own like power pop work with the Reds, Pinks, and Purples. And then COVID hit, and the two guys reconnected in the spring of 2020, summer of 2020, and finished off this record. And it kind of speaks to the lone benefit of COVID. While it took so much from all of us, so many artists finally had time to say, hey, that side project I was working on, hey, that weird partnership I was working on, let's finish that off and we can release it on Bandcamp Fridays. So this came out in the spring of 2021, and it's this, one of the appeals of Woods to me has always been it sounds like a lighter version of Neil Young and Crazy Horse at its absolute best. This is that like kind of warm Laurel Canyon focus of Neil Young's career. It's psychedelic enough in terms of like the backing vocals. There's a lot of mellotron. There's a lot of really weird, unique guitar lines that come through it. But ultimately, at the end of the day, Jeremy Earl's songwriting is what really gets me. And he has such a way of writing in a non-specific way that brings specific memories to the listener. And the album opens with these two lines that I just can't get out of my head. It's the fog that creeps on in the early morning, the same fog that burns right off by the afternoon. It's kind of this vague imagery that you could really apply to any situation in your life. But, you know, as I think about it, it reminds me of I have a young child, I have an infant daughter, and like my mornings start out with the kind of this fog. And slowly throughout the day, it breaks and I'm at a point where like I feel good, I feel at peace. I feel just total love for my kids, for my family, and then I go through the cycle over again. So listening to this record has been a total pleasure in the last couple weeks. It feels like a summertime record. I definitely encourage our listeners to check out Painted Shrines, Heaven and Holy.
Okay, just going forward, classic summer albums from 1991. So in 1991, the summer I was 11, I was at a sleepaway camp in the Berkshires, and I'm pretty positive I did not listen to this album I'm talking about now, because all I remember listening to at sleepaway camp in 1991 was probably Digital Underground, Guns N' Roses, and Third Base, the song Pop Goes the Weasel. You know, Pop, Pop Goes the Weasel. Pop goes the weasel, goes the weasel, goes pop. MC Church. Hell yeah. So the album that I am talking about is from Fishbone, The Reality of My Surroundings. Fishbone to me is a fascinating band because I can think of few bands that were more awesome and yet are just kind of like completely outside the realm of discussion in 2021. Like, they still exist. They haven't put out a record in a while, but they actually, at this point, they're still around, and they actually have many more of their founding members than they had throughout like the late 90s and mid-2000s. But just in terms of being a band consisting entirely of black musicians doing awesome versions of ska, funk, soul, surf music, like everything under the sun shot through Southern California, they should seem to be a much more major band than they are right now. And Reality of My Surroundings, that was their third full-length album. It came out on a major label, and at the time, it was said that this is going to be like a Sgt. Pepper album. Like, some people are going to say it was like the Black Sgt. Pepper, in a way, just because this is a record. It was an hour long. It got them on Saturday Night Live, and it just ran the gamut. Everything, there's punk songs, there's ska songs, the song Everyday Sunshine is a gorgeous Sly Stone tribute. There's even like some stand-up routines throughout it, like done in the form of skits, as was like popular in the early 1990s. It's a fascinating record, and yet it didn't really catapult them into the mainstream in the way that they would have hoped. I think that the way that their label was hoping for. And the follow-up album, 1993, called Give a Monkey a Brain, He'll Think He's the Center of the Universe, while very good, was kind of a step back. It was almost like they thought that they tried too hard in the last record, so they're trying to put their songs in the more digestible form. And I think it wasn't as ambitious and kind of suffered as a result. And I don't think the band ever really like recovered from that album. But looking back, it's just Reality of My Surroundings. It holds up. The songs are great. The ambition is huge. Fishbone were incredible musicians. I think the founding members being the singer Angela Moore, the bass player Norwood Fisher, and the drummer whose name I forget. I think they first all met in high school in the late 70s. They kind of progressed throughout the early 80s, at first just being a ska band, then putting in elements of soul, elements of funk, elements of James Brown. And it just culminated on this one record that I'll never quite understand why it wasn't nearly as successful as it should have been. But it stands as a huge edifice. And you can go back and listen to, I think the first time I ever heard about Fishbone was in the 1989 Red Hot Chili Peppers song, Good Time Boys, which is their tribute to all their buddies in Los Angeles. And they go, talk about my buddies, funk it up, Fishbone. And I'm like, wow, I got to find out who this Fishbone is, because if he's good with Anthony Kiedis, they're good with me. So, friend of the pod, Robert Kerr, is a big Fishbone fan. I know he loves this record. If you get nothing else for this podcast, go back and listen to Fishbone. You'll be shocked and surprised. I wish every day the sun would shine. Take me to another place in my life. Where everything is beautiful. And no wants to need no sun.
So before I go, I was just pulling up albums released in 1991. I just wanted to give a very quick rundown because 1991 is a banger year, and it kind of what we were talking about in 2011, how it showcases this transition of where music is going. You really get that in 1991, plus also a lot of legacy big acts that put out records. So I'm just going to run down the list really quickly, and I just want to watch your face and your mind explode as I'm reading this. My Bloody Valentine, Loveless, Nirvana, Nevermind, A Tribe Called Quest, A Low End Theory, Pearl Jam 10, Talk Talk, Laughingstock, Metallica's Black Album, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Blood Sugar Sex Magik, Primal Scream, Screamadelica, Michael Jackson, Dangerous, Slow Dive, Just for a Day, REM, Out of Time, Smashing Pumpkins, Gish, Blur, Leisure, Tupac, Apocalypse Now, Guns N' Roses, Use Your Illusion 1 and 2, Soundgarden, Bad Motor Finger.
I think a lot of those records all came out on my 12th birthday, September 24th, 1991. That's when you had...
A lot of them came out then.
Yeah, Nirvana, Soundgarden, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Tribe, all came out on September 24th, 1991.
Big shout out to Genesis, We Can't Dance, which following up our big Genesis deep dive that we did last year with Matt Dwyer. I will stand for that record. I will ride for that record. I dig it. And the tour that came off of it was quite good.
I like Fading Lights, the last song on that record. Dreaming While You Sleep. That's kind of about it. But
It was clear that like the end was nigh.
But... Yeah, the end was very nigh. If that record was the Oregon Trail in two turns, you'd be seeing the Colorado.
But careful listeners will know that there was one record I left off this list. And if I cheated in our last segment and put out a record that came out in the springtime for New Album Rex, I'm going to cheat again and talk about a record that came out in the fall. But it doesn't fucking matter because it's one of the greatest albums that has ever been released and is one of the greatest albums of my entire life. It is the most important album I've ever listened to in my entire life. It completely changed the way that I listen to music, and that is U2's Octoon Baby. I have spent plenty of time on this podcast and past podcasts talking about my love for the band U2. I will spare you all the 3-hour deep dive that I could go down just off the top of my head. I will just say that when this record came out, it completely reshaped the way that I thought about music. It introduced to me the concept of a reinvention record, something that I had no concept of at 6 years old when this album came out. It took a band that I absolutely loved, that I loved all of their songs, and remade the way that I thought about who they were, and has since then impacted where I love so many of my artists to go, that kind of dark, hazy, unknown terrain of experimentation that when it works, it works. When it doesn't, you can fall flat on your face, and that's kind of the fun risk period here. So I love this record. It defines 1991 for me from a sonic standpoint, even into 1992. I want to give a huge shout out to my mother, who's the person that pushed this record on me, which is one of the coolest things, not the coolest, but one of the coolest things my mom has ever done for me. And I just encourage anyone here who is not a believer in the power of U2 to just turn out the lights, put on Octoon Baby, and just sit there and listen to the and try not to have the like drums that sound like Larry Mullen is like taking a 2x4 and banging it against like a empty oil drum. Just unbelievable sounds that Brian Eno got out of the band. So I'd encourage anyone who is not a believer, go back and listen to it. Anyone who is, Octoon Baby is one of those albums you can listen to literally 10 times a day, every day for the rest of your life and be totally fine with it. So I would encourage everyone out there, listen to U2, Octoon Baby.
Yeah, Zoo Station is one of those opening tracks. You listen to it and you're like, ah, I see where we're going. All right. All right. I'm on board, man. So thank you for hanging with us in this episode of The Drop. We covered a lot of ground this episode. We talked about new releases, music releases, Osiris releases. We talked about 2011. We talked about new records and Fishbone and U2. I felt pretty good about this episode. So certainly come back. We're going to drop another episode a week from now, August 30th. By then we'll have had a few more Fish shows under the belt. We'll be getting closer to sending my children off to school. It's a little further in the month of August. So, as always, thank you for hanging with us. Thank you for joining together and holding hands in cyberspace. A little kumbaya. And come back, and we'll go into The Drop.
The number you have reached is 100.7 WMMS.
It wasn't just a radio station, it was a lifestyle.
Cleveland is a rock and roll city for sure.
We're gonna be like Chicago's.
Get down!
The Wrath of the Buzzard. WMMS. Cleveland.
The rise and fall of one of the most iconic radio stations in America. Profiles. The Wrath of the Buzzard. PROH Files. Subscribe now wherever you get podcasts.
Hey, what's up? My name's Lurk, and I'm the host of Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast. Every week, I have in-depth conversations with bands from all over the scene, big and small. We also like to keep our finger on the pulse and showcase up-and-coming bands on the show as well. So come check out Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast.